As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Caught it as clean as a whistle.
That's it. He smashed it to the boundary. That's Mark Waugh's 100. 100 on debut. What a magnificent innings it's been.
And that's the 100th for Mark Waugh. Back-to-back centuries. That's a magnificent performance.
Welcome to a special edition of the No Dunks podcast. I'm Lee Ellis. Today, I welcome to the program a guest who is very well known in the cricket world. A glorious and exquisite batsman, a handy medium pace and spin bowler, and still the finest slips catcher the game has ever seen. He won everything from the World Cup to multiple Ashes series and had a huge hand in Australia recapturing the Frank Worrell Trophy after almost 20 years in West Indian keeping. A Hall of Famer who made about the same amount of runs in both Test cricket and the one-day game, in all scoring over 16,000 for his country, and he even registered a fifer as a bowler in both forms of the game, cementing himself as one of the most versatile cricketers in history. And he did it all while having the best hair in the dressing room throughout his entire career. And he joins me on the line from Central Coast, New South Wales right now. He is Mark Waugh. Mark, welcome to the No Dunks podcast.
G'day, Lee. Yeah, that was a good introduction. Not sure about the best hair in the dressing room, but we'll take that. I don't know if that's a compliment or not, but I did have a pretty good mullet there when I first started playing for Australia.
Yeah, well, I think it was the style, wasn't it, in that the late 80s, early 90s. Everyone kind of had one, really.
Yeah, if you didn't have a mullet, you weren't up to speed. So, I just copied everyone else and thought looked okay at the time. Looking back, it probably wasn't the best hair, but at least I had some hair then. It's sort of thinned out quite a bit since those days.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, look, in preparing for this, Mark, I followed your career very closely anyway, and I listened to a few other podcasts you've been on, so I'm going to try to avoid some of the questions that you've probably been asked, the same sort of questions, so it's hopefully not too repetitive for you, and also to give our listeners, which is you know, probably an audience that isn't familiar as much with cricket and yourself, a bit more of an idea of who you are and what made you great at cricket.
Okay.
So I'll start, though, where it all began, because I know you were very naturally gifted when it came to sports. You know, mum and dad were very good athletes. You were good at soccer and tennis, golf and cricket. But what I want to know is, was there a sport that you tried as a kid that you just weren't any good at? You know, swimming or karate or distance running, something like that?
Well, I mean, all ball sports, we've played. Mum and dad were good tennis players, of course, and my uncle was a very good cricketer. He was the leading run scorer for Bankstown Cricket Club, you know, the club that we played for when we were growing up. So there was always sport in the family. I must admit, I wasn't very good at water sports, you know, like surfing, right, and those sorts of things, skateboarding, you know, those sort of things, where skiing, where you needed a bit of balance. Even though I looked quite balanced on the cricket field, balance on those sorts of things wasn't very good. So anything to do with a ball, I was pretty good at. Anything other than without a ball, not so good at.
Yeah, because I imagine, you know, at school and stuff, anytime there was a ball sport, the other kids are probably like, you know, I mean, the Waugh twins here are gonna be pretty good at it. And you know, speaking of that, like playing cricket in Australia in the summer, every kid does it. But I don't imagine it was a whole lot of fun for the neighbours of the Waugh family to turn up and play, unless they just wanted to bowl all afternoon. Is that right?
Well, our neighbours probably didn't play. It was more our younger brothers, Dean and Danny, who were
right.
10 years younger, Danny and Dean 4 years younger, so they didn't get much of a battle of the bowl. They were just fielding most of the time, so it was myself and Stephen doing all the batting and bowling. So they were probably the ones that got the rough end of the stick. And in actual fact, Danny and Dean both ended up very good fields, and probably because that's all they did. And they were in the backyard playing cricket with their older brothers. So, yeah, we didn't sort of play a lot with the neighbours. It was more with the family itself. And then every now and then, mum and dad would sort of get involved as well. But it was just sport 24 hours a day. As soon as you got back from school, well, not 24 hours, we did sleep, of course, but as soon as we got back from school in the afternoons, we just play cricket or soccer or whatever, tennis as well. They were the main three sports, and soccer and cricket sort of, we got to a really good level, myself and Stephen, sort of as teenagers, and we had to make a choice sort of in the late teenage years, you know, which sport we'd sort of follow through with, and that was cricket.
Yeah, so speaking of that, at the time, I mean, soccer's always been a big sport, but it probably wasn't that big in Australia at that time. Given the way that soccer is now, I mean, if you go back in time, do you think there's any chance that maybe you pursue soccer instead, and maybe you're lining up for Man United or Real Madrid or something like that? Or was it always just cricket just always had that pull?
Well, it was always sort of 50-50. Where myself and Stephen are probably pretty good at both sports on a level par. But there's a guy called Robbie Slater who went on to play for Australia, and he commentates on Fox Sports now. He went on to play in England and France. We were actually in the same teams as him all the way through our junior soccer. We came from the same area. So I thought actually myself and Stephen were better players than Robbie when we were younger. So you never know. Look, you don't know. But, I mean, we did pretty well at cricket. So it's hard to say whether we would have had the same impact at soccer. Just don't know. But, you know, we feel that we made the right move. There's probably a bit more money involved in soccer in those days. Probably not now with the IPL and those sorts of things. Cricket's, you know, you can earn a lot of money at the highest level if you're a really good player. So back in those days, probably there was more money in soccer if you went to Europe, of course.
Yeah. Are you a little bit surprised that Australia hasn't really done better on the world stage in soccer? I know in 2006 we made it out of the group stage, but other than that, I mean, when was it, 2018, I think we only scored two goals and they were both penalties at the World Cup. We seem to have sort of taken a bit of a step backwards in that respect. Are you surprised that we haven't, given Australia's passion for sport and our development and infrastructure there, we haven't been able to get better results?
Well, a little bit, but I mean, our best team was probably, about 8 years ago, I reckon. We were very competitive in World Cups. We've probably taken a little backward step in men's soccer, but women's soccer is probably, we've gone up the other way. Right. So, look, I don't know the reasons. Maybe the population. We don't have the same population as the big countries in soccer to produce players. But it probably stems from our A-League, how strong that is, and maybe, you know, players getting overseas experience. Whether that happens as much now, I'm not sure. But, I mean, we do okay, really, for the population we've got.
Yeah. Well, I want to start with your one-day career, because that's where your career started for Australia. You know, you started there about 3 years before you got your chance in the test team. But what was interesting about your one-day career, when you came into the team, I don't know if you remember your first game, you didn't get a bat or a bowl. It was a pretty easy.
Yeah, I do actually, yeah.
Yeah. but then, you started to, you were shuffled around the order a lot. You were batting at, you know, four and five and three. And it wasn't really, you know, you were in and out of the side a little bit. It wasn't until a weird sort of five-game tour of New Zealand in 93 where you opened. And apart from one game, you had either a 50 or 100. And you really, it showed at that time the game was changing, really shifting away from basically just the test team being the one-day team. And someone like yourself, who was a middle-order test batsman, opening the batting for Australia. And it had real success. But after that tour, then you kind of went back down to sort of batting three, four and five. Wasn't it until like 95, 96 where you did sort of cement your place there as an opener? So how did that 93 tour come about, and then why didn't it continue for a couple of years?
Well, when I first played for Australian ODIs, I was batting at sort of five and six. I never got a bat. I'd come in the last four or five overs. It was a little bit frustrating because we had a good top order, and they took up most of the overs, to be honest. David Boone and Jeff Marr, Alan Border, those sorts of guys. So I'd come in right at the end and get a handy little 15 or 16. So I was a little bit frustrated. But on that tour to New Zealand, you're talking about in 93, I got dropped from the test team. And Alan Border just came up to me at the start of the one days and said, you know, do you want to open the batting? And I said, yes, of course I do. And then I had a lot of success there opening the batting. And then I pretty much stayed at the top there for the rest of my career. It might have been a few series there where I wasn't opening, but I mainly stayed there from then on at the top.
Well, I remember because then it was the Ashes Tour of 93, and you and Alan Border actually had a huge partnership in the one-day game. I think it was Headingley, maybe Edgbaston, where Robin Smith made 160 in the English innings.
That's right, yeah.
And then you and Alan Border, you had 113, AB, I think, had 86. But that was, again, surprising because you didn't open that game.
On an Ashes Tour, when you're playing one-days, you've got the same squad for the tests and the one-days. Right. So, you pretty much... keep the openers from the test matches in the one days. It's not like there was two separate teams, so that was probably the reason why I didn't open. I assume they went with Jeff Marsh and Mark Taylor, probably.
I think it was, I think Hayden actually opened.
Hayden, there you go.
Yeah, I think.
Your memory's better than mine, but it's mainly because it's not like a specialist tour for one days. You've got the same players mixing, so. I guess they just wanted to keep the test players, up the top of the order opening in the one days.
Yeah, well, so, speaking of my memory, I was a big cricket fan growing up as a kid. I mean, it was great. Obviously, in Australia, everyone follows it. But when I was researching and preparing for this, I was really going down some YouTube rabbit holes and looking back especially your career, because, it was so influential for me how I played the game. And I never played any high level, but I was always trying to bat like Mark Waugh out there. And I even had the thigh pad, everything. I had all the Slazenger gear out there. But in 1996, the World Cup there, personally, you had an incredible tournament. You got a couple of centuries at the start there. But what I really noticed was how similar the semi-finals were in 96 and then 99 against South Africa. In 96 against the West Indies, Australia 4-15 after 9 overs. And then Bevo and Stewie Law steadied. We got to 207, but it was like, that's not going to be enough against the West Indies. They were then cruising at 2-165 with 9 overs to go before. Yeah, I mean, they fell apart. And then 3 years later in England against South Africa, 213 Australia made there. Another bit of a slow start. Steve got a good 50. South Africa's cruising, none for 48 without loss. Then Warnie comes in and takes those 2.5 wickets, I will say, because I think Gronje just sort of shuffled
it
to
you. It looked out, actually. I thought it was outlier. But
I was watching that over and over again. I think Warnie was just trying to sort of, con the umpire a little bit. He was charging down there. You almost sort of hesitated a little bit when you caught it, as if, like, I'm not sure he hit that, but everyone else is going crazy. And Hansi didn't like it. He didn't want to go at all, but it was...
Well, that was one of those dismissals that actually looked out live. If you're the umpire, you can understand why he gave it out, because it looked like it hit the edge of the bat. Obviously, it sort of come out of the footmarks, and I think Cronje might have hit his foot at the same time.
Yeah.
But to the naked eye, it actually looked out. So
you
couldn't say it was a bad decision.
No.
Even though he wasn't out, it was just one of those things. But, that 96, the 99 semi-final against South Africa, that was the most memorable one-day game of cricket I've played in. I mean, that was amazing. It was so nerve-wracking to play in it, let alone watch it. It's probably worth watching, actually, if you're a fan. And I was feeling it deep mid-off a lot of the time when Lance Cluzen was batting, and he was hitting the ball so hard. He never missed hit a ball that whole tournament. Until right at the end in that over, Damien Fleming bowled, he missed hit a couple. That was the only time he missed hit a ball. So you sort of, as it feels when you sort of want the ball probably not to come to you, even though you should want it to come to you. But at that stage of the game, it's so nerve wracking, and one little mistake, you can lose the game. And we dropped, Paul Rifle dropped a catch. Oh. Damien, Darren Lehman missed the run out in that, what was the last over, from point blank range. And so they said that South Africa cracked under pressure, but we really did as well. A couple of times we had our chances to win that game. And as it turned out, I was lucky enough to field the ball at mid-off and do the backhand flick, which just missed the stumps.
Yeah, were you trying to run out basically whoever is at that non-striker's end?
Yeah.
I mean, you were. I thought so. But
I was just concentrating on picking the ball up first of all, because it was a bit of a scungy shot, sort of bounced a bit rough to me just off the edge of the square. So, I just come across in one motion, picked it up and flicked it. The backhand flick I sort of learnt from playing indoor cricket when I was a young, youngster. So it was quite a natural, throw for me, the backhand flick. So it wasn't like it was a you know, a really extravagant bit of fielding. I was quite used to doing that flick. I was just dirty, didn't hit the stumps, actually.
Yeah. Do you think
cleaned it up.
Yeah. So two things as well about that. How much do you think the ball prior, where Donald basically did back up a little too much and he nearly got run out by Boof there, did that affect him, what he did on that next one? Because I think Klusener was probably in the wrong, wasn't he, for calling him through there?
Well, he shouldn't have called him through. I think there was still three balls left in the over, two or three. Now, if it got to the last ball, you'd obviously have to run. But I would have thought Klusener would back himself to hit a run from the next two deliveries. You know, so they just panicked. You know, they didn't have to run on that delivery. They got away off the previous one where there was a mix-up and Darren missed the stumps. What they should have done was Lance Klusener said, okay, we're not running. I've got the next two balls. I'm going to back myself to hit it through the field.
Yeah.
If I don't happen to hit it through the field, then we've obviously got to run from the last ball. But they stuffed up, really, let's be honest.
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioned the poor rifle drop catch. I mean, it wasn't just a drop catch, but he spooned it over. Yeah, he spooned it over the fence for six. I mean, you know, look, you're in a World Cup. You're all on the same team, of course. But how deflating is that when you're just like, that could have been the game right there. And instead, you know, you almost hand it over to them.
And he had good hands too, poor rifle. Yeah. Obviously from Victoria, where you are. You're from Victoria, aren't you?
That's right. Yep.
Being an AFL player, you know, it was a perfect AFL catch, wasn't it? Just above the head. So he had very good hands. So that's just pressure. And, you know, that happens when you're under pressure. You can make a mistake. So at the time, we all dropped our heads a bit. But in the end, it was all okay.
Yeah, well, and then, you know, when you get to the final, you play Pakistan in the final there, and a bit of a fizzer, really, wasn't it, the final?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you didn't have to chase all that many. I think you finished about 37 not out in the end, but you're only chasing 120-odd. But given the fact the two games prior, I mean, you guys were gone against South Africa in the game before that until Herschel drops the catch.
Yeah,
off Steve, of course. Now, is it true what Steve said to him? I mean, I know it's out there, but he said that?
He said something like, what's on the record? Yeah, it's hard to get much out of Stephen, but it was, I think, pretty much like what's been in the press and what's around the place, that you just dropped the World Cups on that. It was something similar, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Herschel, like he threw the ball away too. It wasn't like he fumbled it. He caught it, but he...
Yeah, he's just a bit impetuous in celebrating, and it was crazy stuff. Like he's a good fieldsman too. He's got great hands. So,
but almost too cocky with it though. Like, you know, I've got this, and ended up dropping it. Just going.
Can you hear
quickly,
the donkey in the background there?
No.
Oh, there's an Eeyore going on the farm.
Right. I saw a little news clip on him, and he moves pretty well out there by the looks of it. I thought Kim hasn't tried to get him out on the track, has she, and see if he can...
He gets in the way enough. He's always in the way. You're driving around the farm in your farm vehicle. He's always running in front of you or next to you or something, or up and down the fence line taking on the thoroughbreds. Yeah, no, he's not sure whether he's a horse, a donkey, a dog or a human. He's a bit of everything, yeah.
He likes the ice creams, though.
He's good on the tooth. Good on the tooth.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Just quickly back to the 96 World Cup. I mentioned, you know, personally, you had an incredible tournament there. You know, you got the 126 against India. And then to top it off, when Sachin Tendulkar's just on a tear, you get him with the crazy white. Yeah, stumped off a white. Ravi Shastri in the commentary box is saying, Mark Waugh spotted Tendulkar coming down the track. I mean, is that true, or is that just
one of
the best bad balls you've ever bowled?
No, of course it was. He played for the spin as well, which is a big mistake from Sachin. But I pushed it through quicker and a bit wider. But Yeah, I mean, that tournament, I did have a good tournament, particularly at the start. I would have liked a few more runs in the semi and the final, obviously, but at the start of the tournament, I was playing well. And that 100 against India in Bombay or Mumbai was probably one of my best, you know, one-day 100s in my career, I think.
Oh, yeah, that was incredible to watch. I mean, that was an incredible match. And again, I think if you don't get Tendulkar out then, I think India probably goes on to win that, because he was just, he was hammering McGrath all over the place. And the pace was... Because those pitches aren't super fast, are they? Their ball sort of sits up a bit, yeah.
Yeah, they're not super fast, but I mean, Tendulkar was a great player, so you know.
Yeah.
You know, you don't. You know, you're almost expecting to win games under pressure for India, and he was pretty much doing that until a masterful bit of spin bowling, shall we say.
And then the chase.
The one that doesn't turn is a beautiful arm ball.
And then the chase against New Zealand, you know, because it was Chris Harris and Lee Jamon who, you know, Chris Harris, I think, hit 130 that game. And you made another ton in that game, incredible century. But that was also when Tubbs threw out Shane Warne to just sort of mix it up. And Deepak Patel dropped in. But then Warney, I think, hit three sixes. He made 30, and it really got the team going again. That's nothing you don't really see anymore, though, in the game, is it? Like, because everyone kind of plays with that aggressive way from the start now. Is that a fair assessment of the current one-day game?
Yeah, I mean, I think you see it a little bit where players are shuffled up the order just to go in and pinch hit. You know, I think there's occasions you do see it these days. In those days, it wasn't seen that often. But if you remember the World Cup in 1990 in Australia, New Zealand and Sri Lanka sort of changed the way to play. You know, they're pinch hitters at the top, scoring quickly. Warney, he came in a little cameo. I remember that innings in Madras. We fielded first and it was so hot. I think I might have bowled 10 overs as well.
Yeah.
And Chris Harris and Lee Jamon got runs. We didn't talk about them much in the meeting the night before. They were two bats we didn't focus on. But when I first went out to bat, there was not much of a break between our innings in the field and then going straight to bat. And at the start of my innings, I actually started to cramp up in my calves, which I never cramp up at all. I thought, geez, this is going to be bad if I'm cramping up early on. But I managed to get through the innings, obviously, in those conditions. Chris Harris, who was made runs, he went out to bowl. He couldn't even run. He was cramping up running into bowl. I remember that. So conditions were really tough. And, I mean, that innings was probably not far behind my innings against India in the lead-up game. So, a couple of big hundreds in tough conditions. It's always, feels good when you do that and get your team over the line, of course.
Oh, I'm sure it does, because, again, it's different when you're defending versus having to chase 280, because a couple of wickets can really turn the contest back into the team that's defending there. But as I say, you got the 100, then Warney came out there and just nice little pinch hit. But I want to shift now a little bit now to your test career, because you obviously started at Adelaide. We know about the big century there, but I want to go actually to your first tour, which was to the West Indies, to the Caribbean. Yeah. They were still a force, and they won that series pretty comfortably in the end. I know you got a century, I think, in the last test match there. But then the following season, 92-93, Australia's on the brink of winning the Frank Worrell Trophy. We only need 186 on that last day in Adelaide. And it disaster struck. I mean, like Kirtley and Courtney came in, and I think it was Tim May made 42, nearly steered Australia home. And then a week later in Perth, Australia really did just look outclassed. Kirtley Ambrose had that incredible spell, 7-for-1, and they recaptured it. And for Australia to be on the brink of defeating the nation, the country, you know, that had dominated us for so long, I mean, it must have just been devastating. I know Alan Border was obviously, for him, especially towards the end of his career there, to have the Frank Worrell Trophy in his hands and basically lose it in Adelaide and then Western Australia, Perth, it was all over. I mean, what was it like for you still early into your career at that point?
Well, I mean, the West Indies were a great team, you know, through the 80s and the early 90s. They were the benchmark. They were so dominant. And you really didn't expect to beat them when you played against them. I remember my first tour to the Caribbean, where I did pretty well, actually, but I just remember the atmosphere in our squad, you know, was a bit negative. You know, we were just there to turn up and play without really having the confidence to beat them. So that was a little bit disappointing from my point of view, but personally I was very happy with the tour, even though I was playing some of the guys I looked up to, guys like Vic Richards. You know, you're on the same field as those guys. I mean, I remember their side. They had Haynes, Greenwich, Richards, Richardson, Dujon, Logie, Malcolm Marshall, Walsh, Ambrose, Bishop. You know, you don't get a much better team than that. And you're almost in awe playing against those guys. So to be on the same field in the same dressing room, it was amazing. But after that, obviously, you're talking about in Australia where Adelaide, where Craig McDermott was given out. After Daryl Hare gave him out. I'm not sure if it was out or not. But anyway, it was given out. And it was so frustrating to lose, to be so close and lose that test, then go to Perth. And let's just give the West Indies the best pitch they can possibly bowl on a fast, bouncy pitch with some grass on it. Let's just make it a little bit harder for ourselves. And Curtly Ambrose was just too good in those conditions. It was ready-made for their quick bowlers. And so close in that series, but, so far, Alan Border was so disappointed because he just copped a hammering his whole career playing against the West Indies. So
and
frustrating for him.
You mentioned it there as well. Like every kid, the thing about the West Indies is like they tortured us all in the 70s and 80s there. But we also kind of like being, well, we all wanted to be Viv Richards as kids. It's like, I want to be Viv Richards. You know, I want to be like the cool guy who just comes out there, no helmet, you know, chewing on the gum, the collar up, hitting sixes all over the place. And was like, this team just comes out here and pounds us every time they come out. But they're so much enjoyable. They're so much fun to watch. They're so enjoyable.
Exactly. I mean, he was my idol, Viv Richards. So, and all the description you just said of him, that's what made him such a special player. But they did not have a bad player in their squad. They really didn't. So, and they had that aura about them. Everyone just loved watching him play.
Yeah. Well, so that brings us then to 95. And obviously one of the most, if not the most significant tour and series victory of your career. I'm sort of saying this myself because there's something else, but just because of all that history and all that drama that have been around there, then you go back to the West Indies. And ironically, the series kind of went the same way as it did in Australia. You guys won the first test. I think it was a draw in the second test. And then the third test, there was like 234 runs total scored.
Yeah.
And Australia lost by an innings. I don't know. I was looking over that and I was thinking, how did that happen? I don't know. The pitch must have just been an absolute minefield out there.
It was a shocker in Port of Spain. The pitch was very damp and you just needed luck to get runs. And, you're facing those sorts of bowlers on those sort of pitches, it's very tough. So, I mean, one all going into Jamaica, into Kingston, which is traditionally a tough place to play for touring teams. And we just got it done. Myself and Stephen put on that great partnership and then we ended up winning that game pretty easy. So it was really the change of the guard. I mean, change in the people who are in the best in world cricket. The West Indies had dominated for probably 10 to 15 years and then we took over. And since then we've sort of kept progressing and the West Indies, unfortunately, have gone a bit the other way.
Yeah, there it is. You might recognise this. It's the Warpath photo.
I do recognise that. So I mean,
I picked that up as soon as they had it for sale. I picked it up. It was only $150. It's worth
that's cheap. But that ground, Kingston, Jamaica, is so intimidating. You know, it's the crowd just want blood. You know, they love seeing guys get hit in the helmet and. You know, it's just an amazing, amazing place to play. I must admit, when I went out to bat in that first innings, I wasn't confident at all. It's funny. Look, I was just hoping to get runs, and then I got through the first 20. I think David Boone was out before me. He brushed his helmet, actually. He got given out caught behind a bouncer flying through, and then, you know, the crowd are just off their rocker, and I went out to bat. I think I got a bouncer first ball. Well, I ducked it anyway. I don't think it was that short, but I thought a bouncer was coming and I got underneath it. Managed to get through the first 20 minutes and then I was right. The pitch was a good pitch to bat on. Obviously, Stephen played a great innings at the other end and that sort of set up the win.
Yeah, I heard on another podcast you were on that your dad, who used to run a news agency, if ever there was negative stuff written in the papers, he used to hide them up the back. So
He didn't like the Australian newspaper too much. Not that they sold many copies out in the west of Sydney, the Australian, anyway.
Yeah, I bet. After that win in Jamaica, there he probably moved a few more copies that following. They were probably like, "Geez, why are we selling so many at the War News Agency today?"
Yeah, he took it a bit personal, Dad. Yeah, he never used to like when we got any criticism, which is going to happen. That's the game, yeah. Isn't it? At the top level, yeah. But yeah, probably not the best business to be in if you get upset by the media having only a news agent.
Yeah, yeah, so, that's right.
But all was good on that occasion.
Yeah, so, you know, speaking of the West Indies, they pretty much, you know, I'm going to briefly touch on the 99 series because that was just an incredible series, but they've really been on decline since then and to the point where they're largely irrelevant now, which is really sad because that was one of the tours I remember used to most look forward to seeing. But when was the last time Australia even toured for a test series in the West Indies? I mean, I don't recall really one in the last 5 years anyway. But
well, I was a selector when we were there last time. I think would have been 5-6 years ago.
Yeah,
because I remember having my 50th birthday in Dominica as a selector.
Right.
I'm 56, so that's 6 years ago.
Right.
But you're right. The demise of West Indies cricket is quite sad because they're so important to the strength of world cricket at the moment. It's really India, Australia, New Zealand and England and the West Indies, they've got a few decent players, but for whatever reason, their crowds have dropped off.
Yeah.
They don't seem to have the facilities to, you know, provide, you know, a good building block for young players. The thing with the West Indies is you've got different islands, different countries, so it's a little bit segregated.
Yeah.
In that way. So, and American sports had a big influence, I think, on the Caribbean. Maybe to a certain degree. So, yeah, it's disappointing, but hopefully they can, you know, get back up there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I hope so too, but it just feels like it's almost just too far gone now because, you know, you just, like, apart from Chris Gayle, they just don't have anyone, and he's obviously passed it as well now, but they just don't have that draw card. You know, they don't have that Viv Richards. They don't have that Kirtley Ambrose. Like, again, watching highlights of that 95 test, Kirtley bowling bounces to you and then the shirt's undone and he's staring at you and you know, I know Steve tried to fight him in Trinidad, I think it was as well. Like,
that was silly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't, you're right, they don't have the big names. I think their captain Jason Hole's about their best player and they've got a few young guys who have done bits and pieces, but nothing of the calibre of years gone by. So I mean they really focus on the short form cricket. T20 World Cups have won them. That seems to be their bread and butter where the money is. So that's where a lot of their players sort of, you know, are focused on, unfortunately. Yeah.
So in 99, you guys went back there. Steve's first series, I think, as a captain, in fact, as a touring captain. And first test goes pretty much to plan. Australia wins. And then that second test was in Kingston, I believe it was. And Brian Lara comes out and him and Jimmy Adams bat for an entire day. And Brian Lara plays one of the most sublime innings I've ever seen. Barely a false stroke. He nearly got himself run out, though, actually, on 99. He survived. But he played, and the crowd, I mean, that was a real throwback to those, you know, early 90s, late 80s crowds. And what I want to ask you is what's it like? How hard is it to keep your concentration in a situation like that where Lara, I mean, you know, McGrath's coming in a bowling and I think McGill plot bowled as well. He's just hitting everyone everywhere all over the place. How hard is it to just with the noise and the heat and the sounds and that for you to be like, I've got to be ready in case a catch comes my way?
Well, it's harder for the bowlers because they're the one copying the stick. But as a player and as a fieldsman, I mean, it's great. I mean, the atmosphere is unbelievable. That's what you play for. You know, you're slightly up against it and the crowd's against you, big crowd, a great players, you know, batting beautifully. I mean, as a fellow opposition player, you know, I don't mind seeing guys like Lara and Viv Richards make runs against you, Tendulkar. You know, they're the great players. So you quite enjoy it. Obviously, you want to get them out cheaply to win the game. But from a personal point of view, you know, it's spectacular when you're watching that sort of class of player making runs. Yeah. And the atmosphere, I mean, I love it when you're up against it and the crowd's ripping into you. I mean, that's, you know, you look at sport now with the COVID restrictions, without a crowd, it's just so much different, isn't it?
But
that's what you play for. You know, you play to obviously win those games, but sometimes, you know, the opposition are too good. And when Lara's on song, sometimes there's not much you can do about it except just, you know, sit back and watch it and clap what he does.
Yeah, I think it was McGill who threw a couple of full tosses in there as well, and it was just
They would have went into the grandstand. Yeah,
yeah.
That was Barbados was a great place to play.
Yeah,
you know, good atmosphere, all those sorts of things. You know, I think there's a guy. He gets dressed up every day and comes to the crowd, and they sort of he stands up and they all applaud him. And then there's a guy called Mayfair and Gravy in Antigua. They get dressed up and come into the ground as well. So real characters, those Caribbean crowds, and lots of fun.
Yeah, I imagine it wasn't. And again, I mean, Lara had another 150 in that series, and then he had another 100. He had 100, and I think the Windies were 4 for 138 at one point. I mean, it was a drawn series, but one of those just incredible, like really good Test cricket. That's what you sort of really miss with the Caribbean, with the West Indies, because it's hard to picture that coming back.
Well, you never know. There might be some young player pop out of nowhere. But I remember Brian Lara. When I first played against West Indies, he was 12th man about 20 test matches in a row.
Yeah.
And he was getting so frustrated, and everyone was saying what a great player he was, but he just had to bide his time because there were so many great players in front of him. But, they need someone like that to really, revitalise cricket in the Caribbean.
So that happened in 99, and then a couple of years later, Australia was on the incredible run of victories and looked like we were going to win in India for the first time in about 30 years as well. Similar sort of situation. We were on top of them. Tendulkar goes in that second innings, and then Lakshman and Rahul Dravid they batted forever. Lakshman, that 280 is again also one of the most incredible innings I've ever seen, because it did not matter what the field was, who was bowling, he just hit everything. What was it like for you again? I mean, I know these are probably not great memories, but in terms of just being in that situation where Australia had been on such a dominant run and we were about to win in a place that had been really tough to win in, to go from that to then, it turned around in one day basically.
It did. Well, we won the first test, didn't we, in Bombay, and then the second test was in Calcutta and Eden Gardens, and we've pretty much, the first couple of days, we dominated that test match. We made India follow on.
Yep.
And I think it was a fair decision at the time by Stephen. It was just a freak partnership between Lakshman and Dravid, which turned the game. We just couldn't get a wicket. We bowled all day. I think I might have been bowling when Lakshman got his 100. I think I served him up a nice full toss for him to get his 100. Bowling some
off spin. That was nice of you.
That was just great play by India. And once again, Calcutta Eden Gardens, it might have been about 80,000 people there. It was amazing atmosphere. So we lost the unlosable game there. And then the last two tests... we had chance to win those as well. Even the last test in Madras, I think India got them 8 down.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of close decisions that could have went either way. And unfortunately, they went against us. But that series was one of the best to play. Every test match was so close and such high quality that, we probably deserved to win that series, to be honest. You know, I think we did, but we didn't. So that's the way it goes.
Yeah, I mean, Harbhajan was just everything he bowled just seemed to sort
30 of 30 odd wickets, I think.
Something crazy like that.
Or something?
Yeah, and I think that was the first time Gilly really struggled too, because Gilly had been batting so well. And I think he had like, 4 innings in a row, he scored only 2 runs or something like that. He just
You got a couple of rough decisions though. I remember one of them was a shocker.
Yeah, there was a couple of LBs, but Punter struggled as well with the spinners there. And that atmosphere, because you say 80,000. I remember, I think it was Tim Lane on the broadcast saying like there were no turnstiles though there, so like they just kind of like they just decide, all right, there's about 80,000 in there, so let's go.
Yeah, the conditions in India in those days, the pitches weren't too bad, but when you first go in, that's when it's so tough. You need a bit of luck early on when the ball's spinning, you've got men around the bat, the crowd's roaring, the bowlers are fizzing, the umpire's in the game. You know, that's when it's so difficult. If you can get through the first half an hour, batting is okay. But those first first dozen or so deliveries, you need a bit of luck. You really do. And if quite often, that's why there's so many low scores, because it's so tough when you first go in.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. you can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Well, let's go back to when you did very first go in for Australia in 91 in Adelaide there. You'd had a long wait to get into the test team and, you know, under very unusual circumstances, you replace your brother in that lineup. But then you just go out there and stroke a 100 as if, you know, you're just playing backyard cricket again with the kids. I remember, you know, you took your helmet off and you know, Roger Federer, whenever Roger Federer wins a Grand Slam, it looks like he's barely sweating. You took your helmet off as if it was like the easiest run in the park. I mean, how much did it help you being a little bit older, a bit more mature and having to sort of bide your time so much, but also getting a taste playing for Australia in the one-day games? Were you just so ready for that moment in Adelaide in 91?
Yeah. Well, I thought I was ready 12 months early, but we'll say it was perfect timing. But I think the main thing was I was in really good form. I'd scored about 3,000 first-class runs that season, if you count my county cricket with Essex. So
yep.
I was really in a rich vein of form. I think playing England as well, I played against a lot of those guys in county cricket. I knew a lot of them, so I was quite comfortable playing against England and also batting at Adelaide Oval. As a batsman, that's probably, you know, one of your ideal scenarios to make a debut test match, you know, on a good batting track. We'd lost early wickets in that particular day, I think 3 or 4 early ones. The hardest bit was batting with Greg Matthews, to be honest. He nearly run me out about 100 times. That was the hardest bit of the innings. But as far as my own batting, I was sort of just in the zone. And, you know, I don't think I hardly miss hit a ball, which doesn't happen often. But I was just cruising, really. Just in the zone. I don't know how I got into the zone, but I wish I got in there a few more times because it was just, just like automatic, you know, automatic pilot, really, the way I played that day.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible to watch. And, you know, obviously that sort of really put you in the team. But then you did have some rough patches after that, not long after that. And you know, this is what I really want to ask you, because in the 90s, in the early 90s, Australia had really good depth at that mid sort of positions in the Australian team. We guys like Damien Martin, you know, Blewett, Buff Lehman, Michael Bevan, Stuart Law, Jamie Cox. I mean, all these guys were making a ton of runs, and a couple of them did get a chance. You know, Marto got a chance for Australia there. Greg Blewett, I think Greg Blewett made a century in both his first two tests, and he made that double down in Johannesburg too. But did you feel, you know, were you looking over your shoulder a bit there when you had a bit of a rough patch here and there because it was such a pool of talent we had?
Not really. I mean, I must have, when I got dropped, I was pretty surprised because I debuted against England, did well in those tests, went to the West Indies, did well over there, came back home. I think I had 2 or 3 bad test matches against India. I got a couple of bad decisions too, but I was actually batting pretty well. So, I mean, I must admit I was surprised I got dropped.
Yeah.
Considering the start to my test career, and I wasn't that long into my test career, so I don't know who the bloody selectors were, but they had no idea dropping me. But I must admit, I was pretty surprised when I got dropped. But, you know, these things happen. You're right, there was a lot of depth in the Australian squad at that time. I think myself and Jeff Marsh got dropped in the same test match, and Tom Moody and a guy called Wayne Phillips, I think, from Victoria came in. And took our spots.
I think we had 5 Victorians in the team at that point because it was a bit of a flex of the muscles from the Victorians. We had Phillips, Dean Jones, Merv, Warney was probably in the team, and maybe Tony Dottomade as well. Maybe.
Well, that was the problem. 5 Victorians. You know, should have been 8 New South Welshmen. But look, I must admit, I was a bit surprised I got dropped. But anyway, these things happen, and you know, you just got to go back and score runs and get back in. So.
And you did that, and then the tour in 93 of England was another very good tour for you in general. I want to take you though to a moment that, you know, probably a bittersweet moment at Lords. You were batting along just effortlessly there. And then Phil Tufnell comes in and he just gets one that sort of comes off your pads and onto the stumps. Yeah. 99 at Lords. I mean, that one's probably got to hurt a little bit now still, does it?
Yeah, it did hurt a bit, particularly the way I got out. As you say, Phil Tufnell was bowling over the wicket. Didn't bowl a particularly good ball. And I just tried to flick it through the onside to get a single. Earlier in the over, I did the same, hit it really well and hit Robin Smith's shin pads and cost me getting the single. So I just tried to do the same shot. Unfortunately, missed it, hit my pad, went through my legs onto the stump. So, yeah, that hurts, especially at Lords and getting a 99 in any test match, but particularly at the home of cricket. So, yeah, well, annoying.
If it's any consolation, it was my deb night that night. I was in year 12 and I had a bet with one of my friends that you were going to make 100 at Lords.
Yeah.
And so we were out the back watching it and I'm just starting to count my money. I had 100 bucks on it here. Anyway, the girls were looking for us. Like, where are the boys? Like, we were supposed to be doing some dances. We're out the back. You know, then all of a sudden...
No, we're out of dance anyway.
Yeah. Well, not only did I lose the 100 bucks in the end, I think I lost my girlfriend as well that night. So.
Yeah, well, I was the only one of the top four that didn't make 100 in that particular thing. So let the team down and let you down as well. Sorry about that.
Fortunately, I recovered from it, but it was one of those funny moments where I was like, because again, it reminded me of Adelaide. It was like you were just scoring so easily, you know. And I know that's one of the sort of things that followed your career. People say, well, you know, Mark's too casual out there, but you know, it wasn't that. I know that. I know I've read a lot and heard a lot about you. Like, it was just the way that the game came to you, and I think a part of it was that. It looked like you were sometimes halfway through a stroke before the bowler had even delivered the ball, especially off your pads there. But, you know, what was it like for you hearing that sort of stuff and you know, having to sort of be like, you know, that's I'm not casual, I care, it means so much to me. You know, I mean, it just must be tough, especially when Steve had the opposite sort of reputation of like, you know, he's going to just bat until, you know, you almost have to shoot him to get him out, you know?
Well, I mean, it's just your style. Everyone plays in a different way, and obviously, when your style is a bit casual looking, like a David Gower or Usman Khawaja, if you do get out, people think, oh, that's just a lazy shot. You know, you don't care, but that's just the way you play, and you get labelled that in your career. It's hard to shake the label. I mean, Stephen was the opposite. He got labelled as being stodgy and that used to annoy him. He used to think he was a bit more flamboyant than what he was given credit for. I mean, the only thing I would change if I look back at my career was when I got to 100, you know, I often got out, got 120 and got out.
Right.
Because I thought the job was done. But, you know, if I went back in time, I'd really nail those hundreds into 200s or, you know, big hundreds. So that was the only thing that sort of let myself down. But if I thought the game was in control or the innings was in control and I'd got my 100, I'd, subconsciously, I just seemed to get out for some, you know, which was a bit frustrating looking back, but that's the way I played. But, you know, it certainly wasn't any easier to me than any other player. When you're batting, it's just your style. It's just the way you come across to other people.
Well, you made 20 test centuries, but 15 times when you scored a century, Australia won the match and there was four draws. There was only one time where you scored a century and Australia lost the match. Any idea which one it was?
Geez, now you got me. I can't remember.
Against Pakistan, you had 116. I think it was in Sydney, actually, about 1996.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What did the rest of the other blokes do? Weren't they?
Let me check. I did have it up here before. Hang on. That's New Zealand. That's that New Zealand here. I've got about a million tabs here still open from all the research.
Well, let's just blame the other blokes. I did my part.
Well, it was a good century, but that was up against, you know, Wasim Akram, of course, and Waqar Yunus. I mean, those guys as well. Like, Wasim, especially being the lefty. I mean, I'm guessing he was probably the toughest, you know, non-right-hander that you had to face throughout your career. Would that be right?
Yeah, you're right. He's one of the finest bowlers too. You know, he bowled quick. He could swing the ball, had a short run-up. He was hard to pick up. You know, he had a quick arm action. He'd often run behind the umpire, then jump out at the last minute. He had all the skills. So he was fantastic. And Wacker Yunus was as well. He bowled quick. He was nasty. He could swing it as well. So they always almost ran off each other, a bit of a competition between each other so you could get the most wickets. So they were two fantastic bowlers, to be honest, yeah.
Yeah, and Wasim, I know Slat's got 100 against Brisbane against the Pakistan, but Slat seemed to really struggle against Wasim with that late sort of in swing. I mean, you probably weren't on the ground at the same time then, but did you sometimes when you're in the box there like going, this guy's not going to make any today, he just can't play this guy? I mean, I know Bluey struggled with like Mushtaq Ahmad as well, you know, with those reverse or the googlies, I guess he was bowling to. I mean, is that something in the dressing room there you're like, I don't like this guy's chances against this player?
Not really. I mean, you get a feel if blokes are in and out of form. There's right. No doubt about that. And everybody goes through it. So if it's not yourself struggling, it's going to be someone else. I mean, you've got six batsmen in the team. It's very rare that they're all in form at the one time. Right. So there's always one or two guys that are struggling on tours or in Australia. So, yeah, I mean, you do get a feeling for it, but you certainly just hope for the best for them and try and help them out in the nets or whatever if they're feeling a bit down, but that's where you need a good team. So, you know, you can't all be doing well at the one time, but if you're a good side, you can carry players who are a little bit out of form.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously you spent a lot of your career playing with Steve. How did it change? Did your relationship change at all when he became captain? I mean, did you have to sort of, you just kept going as normal? I mean, what about when he made everyone wear the baggy green caps? Because you were the broad brim guy. I mean, did that cause any tension there?
No, not really. Our relationship didn't change once he was captain. Not really. No, I'm just one of the team, and Stephen's one of the other team members as well. That's the way you got to play. You're not going to get any favours off your brother, and you don't expect them. And
yeah,
so you just treat each other as another team member, and that's the best way to keep it. Obviously, you have those extra feelings being, you know, brothers and whatever. But you're just playing. You're just one of the team members, and that's the best way to keep it, I think.
Well, Mark, listen, you've been very generous with your time here, so I'm going to wrap it up here. But before we go, I've just got one more question for you, and it's completely off the cricket field. It's back to the horses, because I know you're obviously a big horse racing fan there.
Yeah.
And I had Bruce McAvaney on this pod last year, and obviously he's a huge horse racing fan as well. And so I pitched this fictional race to him, and I want to pitch it to you just to see who you think would win. So imagine this. It's a Saturday afternoon at Rose Hill, beautiful day. Good track. Mm-hmm. The race is over 1,400 metres. And we've got Winx versus Black Caviar. I don't know if you remember the Super Challenge back in 91, 92, Let's Elope and Better Loosen Up, but it's basically that in a fictitious manner. Okay, we've got Luke Nolan on board, Black Caviar, Hugh Bowman on Winx, of course. Now, before I pitched it to Bruce, I asked a friend of mine who's a big punter as well. I said, you know, give me some odds. Give me some money lines here for this. And he's like, well, he says that the distance favoured Black Caviar, a sprinter, but Winx needed another furlong or two. So he put Black Caviar at $1.70 and Winx at $2.20. So if Mark Waugh's got a few, he's found $5 down the back of the couch and he can throw it on, where's it going? Where's the money going?
Oh, geez, great horses. I think 1,400 round Rose Hill. I think Black Caviar would lead and just have too much dash for Winx. Winx would be winding up in the last 100 metres, but Black Caviar would just hang on and win. At $1.70, so Black Caviar just.
So you would have had a few winnings then that day if that race was to happen.
Yeah, that's the way I'd read it. But yeah, no, I've been involved in horse racing all my life. Obviously, my wife's a well established trainer. We have a farm on the Central Coast where we spell our own horses. So there's 40 odd horses on the farm. So horses in the backyard out here. When I'm looking out the back, it's just a huge part of my life. Obviously, cricket with the commentary still there, Fox Sports. But horse racing is huge for us. We own a lot of horses. Kim trains a lot of horses. She's had great success. So it's pretty exciting. I mean, I don't have the adrenaline rush of playing top-level sport anymore, but I have the adrenaline rush of, you know, horses racing in big races, and it's a big thrill, actually, if you have some success.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, when you're touring England or, you know, anywhere, really, if there's horse races, it gives you a little bit of an opportunity to... No, but, I mean, you know, when you're on tour... I imagine that sometimes it gets a little bit tough when you're like, you're a bit homesick or whatever. And, you know, so to be able to have something that's another passion of yours nearby, I imagine that's a lot of fun, especially if you're at Royal Ascot, Epsom Derby, wherever.
Well, I've seen a lot of race courses overseas on cricket tours, Royal Ascot, but Barbados in the West Indies, it's one of the my favourite race courses to go to, actually. The Barbados Cup was on there a number of times when we were touring. So I've been to race courses there, India, England, New Zealand. There's not a race course I haven't been to in another country. So,
hey, have you been to the...
Ricky Ponting, his nickname's Punter. So yeah. You know, he was always keen on the races as well. So, yeah, it was always a good... A good way to stop thinking about the cricket.
Yeah, is he still? He was the big greyhound man, wasn't he, Punter? Yeah,
he was. He's had a few horses too. He's had a few horses right. That my wife's trained. And he's had shares in. So,
right.
He's an all rounder. He loves greyhounds and the thoroughbreds as well.
I hope you're getting a commission off those that he's investing there then as well.
Yeah,
is
exactly.
The Kentucky Derby or any of the US horses at all on your radar? I mean, obviously not right now. Things aren't great, but yeah, at some point.
Yeah, we'd love to come to the Kentucky Derby. So it's definitely on the to-do list when we can get out of our own country. So, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think Kentucky's a beautiful part of the world. A lot of the studs up there and obviously the Kentucky Derby. So, yeah, definitely want to get there one day.
All right, well, Mark, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed talking to you about so many fantastic moments in your career. And hopefully, yeah, you can get out and get over to the Kentucky Derby and, you know, pack a few winners from there one day.
All right, Lee. Good to talk to you, mate. I've lost my voice now for talking so much. So good stuff.
Thanks, Mark. You could stay.